black slime onto the pier. They send us a few gifts every now and then. Ghost ships, the crew flayed and stuck to the masts, just to remind us they're out there, waiting. More and more of them every season.
Some less now, said Oscus. You can arrange our repairs?
The dockmaster nodded.
If you have the coin, I'd say we can.
He scratched his wispy beard.
But repairs like this, it'll cost you. If you can't pay the docking fees, we'll take it out of her hull, and you'll pay the rest in blood to the high captains.
Callis saw Xenthi's hand twitch to her sword hilt. She had her hood up and was standing amongst the rest of the crew.
We've got your coin, said Oscus, his voice deadly even.
He gestured, and several elves hauled a sheet of skinned gyre shark hide forward. The quills had been plucked out and the skin cured, leaving a thick, oily-looking leather covered with circular pockmarks. It didn't look all that appealing in Callus's opinion, but Chev had explained that when properly treated and worked, it could stop a crossbow bolt or a sword blow. It was also light and supple, which suited sailors well. You did not want to be fighting at sea in heavy plate or chain. The dockmaster whistled as he hobbled up the gangplank towards them. He knelt by the thick, barbed leather and ran a hand through the hide. He yanked his fingers back with a hiss, and Callis saw a thin line of bright red blood.
You were lucky, it seems,
he said, sucking the blood from his gashed hand.
There's always a market for good shark hide, and this looks like a fresh kill. We'll take it all.
There was an uncomfortable silence. Oscus let it hang long enough for Captain Xenthi to sound an objection, but she said nothing. Eventually, the first mate nodded and gestured for the crew to bring up the rest of the shark hide. The dockmaster gave a black-toothed grin.
We'll arrange a repair crew, he said. There's ale pits and bawdy houses aplenty, should you need to avail yourself.
You bring us the supplies, we'll make the repairs, said Oscus. No one steps on this ship but my own crew. Are we clear about that?
As you like,
shrugged the small man, wiping sweat from his greasy brow. He hobbled away down the ramp, muttering to his attendants. Oscus turned to Xenthi.
That's our prize gone, he said.
His eyes were narrowed, fixed upon the retreating dockmaster.
We should have opened that wretch's belly. This is robbery, plain as the rising sun.
Of course it was, said Xenthi. This is Bilgeport. It was built by thieves. But we must play this carefully for now. We are short-handed and undergunned, and we're resting in a pit of vipers. As much as I'd like to nail that stinking rat to my prow, we need to keep our heads beneath the surface. She turned to Tol. You'll find the Duardin at the sky dock, she said. Port side.
What will you do? Asked Callis. Repairs to the thrice lucky will take some time, said Oscus. Several days at least, if we can even trust that stunted wretch to deliver us the materials we need.
Then we sail back to Excelsis, said Xenthi. I'm done with this fool's errand. Chapter 23
That's the thrice lucky,
Captain Caskin snorted, dabbing at his great sweaty mass of a forehead with a silk handkerchief.
The Wolf of Excelsis. That ship broke the 10th Karen blockade. That half-wrecked piece of flotsam is the flagship of the famed fleet master, Arika Xenthi.
He giggled a childlike nasal sound.
They've seen hard fighting, said Captain Lawse.
Where Caskin was a painted walrus of a man, dressed in garish greens and golds, Lawse was wiry and weathered, with the scars and burns of a life spent fighting and killing on the open seas.
They've masked it well enough, but that's a vicious wound in the lower hull. They're lucky they made it to port.
Not so lucky, said Captain Azrek.
The Duardin leaned against the far wall, his muscles folded, stubby fingers covered almost entirely with gleaming rings. Ortam Vermeer,
moved to the balcony of the High Captain's Lodge, leaning against the rail and looking out over the harbour. He could see the tiny figures upon the deck of the Thrice Lucky, to-ing and fro-ing as they hauled crates of cargo onto the pier. He had arrived here a half day before Toll and his band. The witch hunter had made better progress than Vermeer had expected, though it seemed they had suffered for their haste. "They've lost half their crew," he said. "They're weak and exhausted. You'll never have a better chance to end Captain Erika Zenthi. And with her dead, her crew slaughtered, that leaves the Excelsis Harbour without an overlord, and you three gentlemen with an intriguing opportunity. To control the docks of the City of Secrets," muttered Lorse. "That's real power, real coin." Vermeer smiled beneath his mask. He had considered passing by Bilgeport and heading straight for the Fate Scars. His Zangor allies had their own unique methods of transport, and so there was no need to buy passage upon an air vessel. But Vermeer had known that Toll would travel here eventually, and had sensed a chance to spring a trap upon his pursuer and retrieve something of value in the process. Vermeer could feel Azrek's eyes boring into him, and turned to meet the Duardin's gaze.
"What do you get out of this, masked one?" Azrek said, narrowing his slate-grey eyes. A vicious skull-shaped brand covered the left side of the Duardin's face, turning his frown into an ugly leer. A former slave, this one, so the stories said. Of course, that painful history hadn't stopped the good captain dabbling in the trade himself. In fact, he was an infamously cruel and ruthless master. Vermeer had dealt with the High Captains many times before, though always through intermediaries. It was amusing to think that these three men were standing next to one of their greatest benefactors, completely oblivious as to his true identity. They had been useful privateers, allowing him to direct Bilgeport's raider fleets to targets that would most benefit Ortam Vermeer, the trade convoys of his rivals, for instance. They were the perfect tools for his current needs. A simple play upon their greed and their envy of Erika Zenthi had opened the door, and it had been a simple thing to open their eyes to the many possibilities of a world without the elven corsair.
"I desire only one thing in exchange for the information I have just given you," Vermeer said. "There is an elf girl aboard that ship, with scars upon her face. I require you to hand her over to me, unharmed and untouched. That is the only payment I require. A simple reward for alerting you to Captain Zenthi's presence, no?"
The Duardin snorted.
"Believe that I have a vested interest in eliminating Zenthi and her crew," Vermeer continued. "She travels with two humans, an old man and a former Free Guild soldier. They die alongside the good captain."
Kaskin waddled over to a large cushioned curule and heaved his great bulk into it. The seat groaned like a dying man. Like everything else in this building, the curule was a riot of violent colour, a pink silk cushion propped up by golden limbs fashioned in the shape of a hunting cat's claws. Gems were studded into the arms and down the length of the beams. Vermeer, who'd long lived amongst the high classes of Excelsis, took in the rest of the chamber, with its eclectic styles and shades. Its serving staff dressed in long, violet togas, skin painted light blue, and mouths hidden behind gauze cloths. It was a poor man's idea of a rich man's luxury, and all the oils and expensive perfumes in the world could not erase the stench of fish guts drifting in through the open window. Captain Kaskin snapped his fingers, and a slave girl emerged with a cold towel and began to mop Kaskin's brow. He stared at Vermeer through piggy eyes.
One would be forgiven for thinking that the reason you wish Xenthi slain is because she comes here looking for you, he said. One might wonder exactly why the Fleet Master of Excelsis might be out here on the hunt. I'd wager that stone-hearted creature wouldn't leave her lair unless she was chasing coin or something else valuable.
The shrewd man who hides behind the illusion of a fat fool. One does not become a high captain unless one is both clever and ruthless, thought Vermeier. Yet his greed makes him predictable.
Perhaps we should take off that mask, said Azrek.
A knife had appeared as if by magic in his hands. He spun it around with quick-fingered grace.
Prize it off your face and see what lies beneath.
Vermeier's mouth filled with hot bile. A voice was telling him to do just as the Duwardin had said, to tear the golden mask free and unveil his true shape. He bit his lip so hard that he tasted the sweet metal tang of blood. That would be unpleasant, he said. His voice was even and calm, betraying nothing of the storm within. For both of us.
You threaten me, here, snarled Azrek. In my own chambers, I could have you flayed alive.
That was not a threat, High Captain. This is. Vermeier rapped his staff hard upon the floor. There was a sickening thud from outside the room, and then a high-pitched scream that was abruptly cut off. The doors swung open, and two of Vermeier's Zarngors strode through. Their mottled blue feathers splattered with gore. One of them was holding up the bloodied corpse of a guard, his throat slashed open. The creature cocked its head, wiped its silver dagger on the dead man's nape, and let the corpse fall to the ground with a sickening thud. Do not bother calling for aid, Azrek, Vermeier said, leaning upon his stave and enjoying the Duwardin's look of outrage. It would only result in more dead.
You bring these beasts into our city? Gasped Lors, hand hovering above his pistol.
To prove a point, if I wished you three dead, I would have my allies here slit your throats while you slept. Be assured I have no interest in removing you from power. There was a long silence. Captain Azrek stared at him, unflinching. Eventually, Kaskin broke the tension with another high-pitched giggle.
Gentlemen, please, said the large man, waving a hand to dismiss the now terrified serving girl and taking a deep swig from a goblet of crystal wine. Captain Azrek, Captain Lors, I assume that you, like me, recognize that the ship indicated to us by our masked friend here is indeed the thrice lucky?
Azrek said nothing. Lors approached cautiously, one hand resting upon the pearl-handled pistol on his hip. Vermeier could hear the sound of rushing blood, and the color seemed to fade from the garishly decorated chamber. It would be such a simple thing to reach out and crush the throats of these arrogant fools, to put out their eyes and hurl them from the tower, to hunt down Toll and show him the truth of what he was, to see the fear and horror in his eyes before he... No, he would not give in to that. Loss of control was loss of power, and he would not allow himself to suffer such indignity. He took a deep breath and squeezed his eyes shut. When he opened them again, Azrek had taken a seat and tucked the knife back in his belt.
Suppose it doesn't matter who you are, said the Duwardin, for now.
Exactly, said Kaskin. We capture Xenthi and her crew, and we put them to death, publicly and messily. We show the captains of this port that we bow down to the elves no longer. We will take what is ours by right.
Vermeier frowned.
Do not toy with these people, he said. Kill them quickly and definitively. As long as they are alive, they are dangerous.
No, said Kaskin, shaking his head. We have to send a message. We have to let the crews know that Xenthi's power is crushed, completely and irrevocably.
Then show them her severed head.
Xenthi's shadow has loomed over Bilgeport for years, said Azrek. Her ships have sunk our fleets, stolen our booty, and butchered our people. Her name is spoken with reverence and dread within these walls. Death alone won't banish that fear.
Vermeer sighed. So be it. Let these fools play out their little farce. As long as Xenthi and her crew were delayed and thrown off the hunt, it mattered little to him. By the time they recovered, it would be too late.
You let us worry about the how of it, the Duardin continued. They're in our court now, alone and vulnerable. Let us see how the legendary Captain Xenthi manages without her lackeys around.
Very well, said Vermeer. I leave the means of their destruction to you. Your men will deliver the girl to me exactly as you find her, untouched and unharmed. Tell them to take her to the Jade Golem. I have quartered there. Then our business will be done, and I shall take my leave of your fine city. He stood and gave a cursory bow, then marched out of the chamber and down a wide curving staircase with an ornately carved ivory rail. Statues and busts of the current high captains were ensconced upon the walls, alongside their predecessors. Trophies of all descriptions were mounted alongside, guns, swords, and weapons from 100 different cultures, stuffed animal heads, and the skeletal remains of slain creatures. He would need to be wary of these men. They may be thugs, but they were no fools. During his time as High Arbiter of Excelsis, Vermeer had become very well acquainted with the brutality of the High Captains. He had even called upon their services from time to time through an intermediary. He had carefully ensured that they stayed out of the sights of the Order of Azir's hounds, as well as the city's regiments. Bilgeport had prospered under his stewardship, and it appeared, judging by the number of sails and corsair ships in the Reaver City's harbour, that his successor had not decided to clamp down on their activities, at least for the moment. No doubt the captains were continuing to pour coin into the pockets of the Excelsis establishment. If they garnered enough support, they could even gain the leeway to pursue their foolish war against Xenthi's privateers. It mattered little. They needed only to do their part this day, and he could put them out of mind.
This is a delightfully colourful place, said Ecclesius. How charmingly ramshackle everything all is. And I don't think I've ever witnessed such a gathering of ne'er-do-wells and cutthroats.
Yes, well, you can't smell it, muttered Chev, wrinkling her nose, so I hardly feel you're getting the true picture. The docks were busy and swelteringly hot. She saw a wide variety of illicit goods being bartered and sold right off the deck of moored vessels. Much of it was rare skins and other items stripped from the area's diverse wildlife. One wide-decked galley was almost entirely covered by mottled sea serpent hides of various hues. Others were stuffed with cages from which trapped animals were issuing outraged hisses and squawks. A man brushed past Chev with a cage slung over one shoulder, containing a spider-like creature with garish purple bands upon its segmented limbs. It slammed its many-eyed head against the bars, to no avail, before its bearer disappeared into the crowd.
So much life, sighed Ecclesius.
He was clearly in his element.
You don't know how much it means, Miss Arklis, after so long alone. I must thank you for bringing me out into the world.
Don't get too comfortable yet, she warned. For Myers out there somewhere, and I'm sure he'd love to get his hands on you again.
Yes, well, our witch-hunter accomplice seems a capable man. I am sure he will get his man, and then perhaps we can look to the future.
Excuse me?
You and I are kindred spirits, Miss Arklis. We are both explorers, intrepid souls who brave the unknown in search of secrets that none have unearthed in thousands of years. Granted, I am somewhat less mobile than I used to be, but think of the partnership we could form. I simply must see more of this new world that has spread out before me. Excelsis, this city of secrets, for one. I hear that the entire city is powered by prophecy. Remarkable.
You mean you want me to take you sightseeing?
Pray do not be so dismissive,
the realm's walker said, with a hint of reproachfulness.
My knowledge of these lands is extensive. Imagine how useful my expertise could be to you on your next expedition.
Let's try and survive this one first, she said, though in truth his offer intrigued her. To have someone at her side who had truly lived through the days of the Age of Myth, a renowned explorer, no less.
Please, at least, consider my offer. Think upon it.
The docks gave way to a sprawling shantytown of tumble-down shacks, built from bone and driftwood and covered with hides and leathers. Callis followed Toll through the heaving mass of bodies, hand placed carefully over his coin purse, although the paltry offering within would hardly set a thief's heart aflame with greed. He scanned the local populace as he walked, taking in an eclectic blend of cultures and clothing styles. Here and there strode silk-smothered popinjays, faces powdered and heavy cutlasses slung rakishly upon their belts. These were privateers who thought themselves gentlemen and delighted in aping the trends of Azerite high society, even as their teeth rotted away from swigging rancid grog and smoking hasker weed. Their brightly coloured tunics and ruffs stood out amidst the swirling mass of bare-chested, tattooed sailors, hard-weathered men and women who bore all the hallmarks of a hard life spent out on the open ocean. A Duardin missing both his legs spat something unpleasant-sounding as Callis strode in front of his path. The amputee was dragging himself along in a wheeled cart fashioned from the shell of a crustacean, which also housed a number of bottles of brownish alcohol and a crude yet vicious-looking blunderbuss. There were fat merchants wrapped in exotic drapes, holding their noses as they were carried through the grime-encrusted streets on creaking palanquins. It reminded Callis a lot of the Excelsis docks, though somehow the place managed to be even less reputable. With no free guild patrols to keep even a cursory watch over the marketplace, the cutthroats and belt-cutters roamed freely, drifting through the river of people like sharks on the trail of spilled blood. "Charming place," said Chev, following behind.
"I've got earth beneath my feet and the promise of liquor. As far as I'm concerned, this might well be paradise."
Several skinny, dirty street kids skittered past, and Callis felt a hand brush against his belt, searching for something to prize free. He grinned.
"Not bad," he yelled after the retreating children, "but I'm afraid I'm a poor mark."
The lead urchin, a small, freckled, redhead girl with matted hair, turned and flicked him an obscene gesture, following up with several crude suggestions as to his possible ancestry. He gave her a wave, and she ran off through the crowd.
"I knew you were a city boy," said Chev, "but I didn't figure you as a gutter snipe."
"Benefits of a criminal youth," said Callis with a grin. "I mixed with a bad crowd, so my mother used to say. Believe me, it came in pretty handy when I was in the city guard."
"You don't have to tell me," Chev said, flashing him a wide grin of her own. She raised one hand with a flat, round coin pinched between her thumb and forefinger. His last glimmering. He gave her a mock bow, genuinely impressed.
"The Square of Prophets was my domain," she said. "Plenty of old fat merchants and priests wandering through, their pockets filled with all manner of interesting things."
"I had no idea I was speaking to a master of the craft," said Callis as they walked on. You grew up on the streets?
I did, she replied. Learned a few tricks from the best pickpockets and second-story artists in Excelsis. That was a long time ago.
You're full of surprises, he said.
They trudged up a rickety, curving ramp that led them to another level of the port, a bazaar filled with stalls and great circular tents. The crowds here were even thicker than in the hovels below, though it was clear that this was a place of business. Offers and counter-offers of merchants rang out over the general din of noise and hissing cookpots, hawking all manner of illicit goods. Callis saw Excelsis-forged steels, barrels filled with wriggling fork-tongued amphibians, and bales of sirigrash, a sickle-shaped plant harvested from the sea floor that the Excelsis city guard had long ago banned due to its occasional side effect of causing delusional madness in those who sampled it. In fact, as he glanced at the bewildering variety of produce on display, Callis noted a score of shipments and substances for which you'd earn a lengthy spell in the dungeons if you tried to flog them on the streets of Excelsis.
There,
said Toll, as they reached the far end of the marketplace and emerged onto a wide, flat balcony that overlooked the greater city. Far in the distance, built upon a rising spire of bone and rusted metal, they could see the skyport. Four Duardin vessels rested there in great berths, lit by sunlight that poured through holes in the shell of the dead behemoth. They were squat, powerful-looking airships, rippling with cannon and reinforced steel. From the deck of each protruded great metal spheres covered with vents and rivets. It seemed impossible that such a heavy vessel could ever stay in the air. But Callis had seen the Sky Masters of the Caradron in battle before, and knew well just how agile and deadly their craft could be. The lift that took them up to the skyport was a worryingly ramshackle construction of rusted cables, cogs, and tow ropes, manned by a surly gang of humans and Duardin who lounged drinking and playing cards. As Toll approached, they stopped their game, eyeing him curiously.
I would speak with the captain of those airships, he said, gesturing to the platform far above their heads. Take us up. Want to speak to the Cloudbeards, do you?
Snorted an old grey-haired Duardin, with a metal hook on one stubby arm.
Hope you've brought plenty of coin, boy. They'll have the shirt off your back before you can blink. You let me worry about that, said Toll.
The old Duardin shrugged and snapped his fingers. Two of his crew rose grumbling from their seats and made their way over to a great barrel-like device covered in soot and grime. The greybeard gestured for them to stand upon the platform, and they obliged. One man hauled upon a great brass lever built into the strange device, and it began to cough and smoke. Slowly, the great cogs next to the platform began to creak and rotate, with a grinding, squealing sound.
This does not look safe, said Callis, gazing up at the lip of the skyport above.
Calm yourself, said the old Duardin. We ain't had an accident in at least a couple of days.
His cackles were drowned out by the roar of the engine and the clattering of gears, and the platform began to rise. Callis badly wanted to hold on to something, but there were no rails. He watched with a distinct sense of unease as Chev ambled right to the edge of the platform and peered out over the side as the ground fell away underneath them. With only a few heart-rending stalls and stutters, they finally made it to the edge of the skyport. Ahead was a veritable minefield of crates, barrels, containers, scattered tools, and ropes. Working their way through this maze of detritus, hauling and stacking the cargo upon the decks of the docked skyships, were dozens of Duardin, dressed in black and red leathers. Even in the heat, Callis could see not a scrap of flesh beneath their heavy suits, and each wore an intimidating metal mask shaped in the image of a scowling Duardin face. Ridged silver plates formed a beard, and across the eyes and mouth were perforated vents and lenses that resembled the scopes of iron-weld firing pieces. One of the Duardin spotted them and made his way over, a hand resting upon the golden handle of a many-barreled scattergun wedged into his belt.
Those lackwits below are very clearly instructed to ring the damned bell before they send anyone up, he snarled.
His mask turned his words into a metallic growl, but his accent was surprisingly clipped compared to most of the Duardin that Kallus had encountered. Toll approached, hands raised.
I'm here to speak with Captain Bengtsson, he said. Admiral, said the Duardin. Admiral Bengtsson, and he is disinclined to receive visitors while he is preparing for the fleet's departure. In short, we are busy, and we have no time for any more honest, above-board dealings from smooth-talking conmen.
He'll want to speak to me, said Toll. I represent the Order of Azir, blessed seekers of His Divine Majesty the God-King, and I have an offer for your Admiral that he will want to hear.
The Duardin eyed them for a long moment, then nodded.
Wait here,
he said, and headed off towards the largest of the three airships. Up close, they could see the magnificent craftsmanship of the vessel, the gilded panelling that formed the broad, deep hull, and the gleaming barrels of swivel guns and rotary cannons that lined the gunwale. Kallus whistled.
Serious firepower, he said.
The Caradhron do not believe in moderation in warfare, said Toll. I've witnessed the results of an airship bombing run. Only rubble, fire, and ashes left behind.
Kallus had spent his life around the guns and siege engines of the Iron Weld Engineers, and he had thought their weaponsmiths amongst the finest in all the realms. Yet these vessels made the inventions of the cogheads seem almost primitive. The largest was a broad, deep-hulled monster of riveted iron plates and layered panels of gold, marked by Duardin runes, and bearing the enormous sculpture of a stern, long-beard god upon its prow. Its surface bristled with bombs and cannon of every conceivable variety. There was more firepower there than in an entire artillery detachment. A great engine sphere rested on top of a squat cabin that ran along the rear of the ship. The enormous metal orb was lined with vents and beaten panels of corrugated iron, and dotted here and there were opaque portholes that glowed with a faint blue light.
Sigmar's teeth! I can't wait to fly on one of those, he muttered.
Chev raised an eyebrow.
So, hurtling through the air on a lump of metal is fine, but a bit of sailing gives you the jitters?
At least I know if I fall overboard, I'll be dead as soon as I hit the ground, not splashing around in the dark with a thousand unspeakable horrors drifting ever closer.
Unless you land in the water, of course.
Kallus shrugged, conceding the point. The Duardin who had addressed them strode up to a bolted door built into the side of the airship and rapped on the metal with his gauntleted fingers. After a few seconds, the hatch opened, and the crewman hopped up a short flight of steps and disappeared into the vessel.
I wonder how it all works, said Chev,
raising one hand to her brow as she squinted up at the enormous vessel.
How do you keep something so heavy in the air?
I've heard Ironweld folk ask the same questions and get nothing but frosty glares in reply, said Kallus. They keep to themselves, to the sky folk. Don't appreciate people poking their nose into their affairs. I'm sure they'll just love you.
As they watched, a Duardin in a bulky armored suit, much heavier than the ones his fellows wore, emerged on the deck of the rightmost ship. A metal sphere, not unlike those mounted upon the airships, ascended from the shoulders of the rig, attached to a large fin of corrugated steel. They looked on, astonished, as the Duardin rose into the air, moving with unbelievable deftness and agility despite the bulkiness of his equipment. He came to rest upon the very top of the engine sphere of the nearest vessel, one of the smaller gunships, and they saw the flare of a handheld torch as he began to hover over the superstructure of the vessel, welding and hammering panels.
If it's not magic, I've got no idea how it's possible, said Kallus, shaking his head.
After several minutes, the hatch of the flagship creaked open, and the Duwadin re-emerged. He strode over to them, pausing every now and then to bellow instructions to his crewmates.
Admiral Bengtsson will speak with you, said the Duwadin, gesturing to Tol. Alone. Stow your weapons. I'll search your pockets, too. Never can be too careful where business is concerned.
To Kallus's surprise, Tol nodded and removed his coat, handing it to the armored Duwadin. The Caradron whistled and two of his crew approached, patting the witch hunter down efficiently and with no thought for comfort. They removed his shoulder holster and his two pocket guns he kept tucked in the metal cap of his belt, as well as a small armory of blades and unidentifiable paraphernalia. Tol bore the thorough patting down without complaint, safe in the knowledge that they missed several of his most subtle and lethal devices. The Caradron snorted with amusement as he rolled a small sphere of bronze in his hands.
You've no shortage of interesting toys, human, he said. Impressive.
I would be very careful with that, friend, said Tol, as one of the Duwadin passed his jacket back to him.
Gunnery Sergeant Drock, the leader said. Grundkor, follow me.
Kallus and Chev made to follow, but Drock held up a hand.
Just him, he said. You two, wait here.
This might take a while, said Tol. Head back to the alehouse we passed, beyond the free market. The Drowned Rat.
Appealing in name as it was in appearance, muttered Kallus.
Just keep to yourselves and wait for me, said Tol,
before turning to follow Drock towards the enormous skyship. Chapter 24 The great door groaned open, and Tol followed Drock into the depths of the ironclad. It was gloomy inside, a cramped tube of looming bulkheads and corrugated walls, lit by foul-smelling lamps that cast a hazy orange light across the walls. Tol passed chambers stuffed to the ceiling with crates, barrels, cages, and other paraphernalia, lashed together with leather bindings and overseen by yet more masked Duwadin. They gazed impassively at him as he passed. It might simply be an illusion of the mind, but the interior of the vessel seemed far larger than he had expected. Everything was functional, utilitarian. There was not a stretch of wall or floor given over to aesthetics rather than practicality. Its smell was sharp and bitter, but not entirely unpleasant. The chemical tang of oils and work leathers, sweat and hard labor. Drock tramped up a short flight of corrugated stairs and came to another bulkhead, secured by a heavy door, upon which was marked a series of runes that Tol could not understand. His knowledge of the Sky Folk's language was passable, but each of the Caradron skyports had their own cultural subtleties and linguistic quirks. From the markings he had seen upon the vessel's hull, Bengtsson's crew hailed from Barak Zilfin, one of the largest of the Sky Folk's enclaves. The gunnery sergeant rapped sharply on the door, and there was a barely audible grunt from within. Drock heaved the door open, revealing a small, dimly lit chamber dominated by a huge ironwood desk. Surrounding this ornately carved piece was a thick jungle of towering paperwork, scrolls, tomes, and charts of all description, stacked together in piles so immense it seemed they would crush a person if they were to fall. In the midst of this forest of fading yellow papyrus sat another armored Duwadin, hunched over a desktop scattered with maps and ethermatic gadgetry, lit by an egg-shaped lamp of polished bronze that dangled from the ceiling on a copper cord. Just as the rest of his crew, Admiral Bengtsson was clad in a full-body leather oversuit and a mask that entirely covered his face. His mask was by far the most ornate that Tol had seen, however. It was fashioned from gleaming gold, the lower portion forming a great wedge-like beard and sweeping moustache, the upper half an imposing Duardin frown. The eyes were sky-blue sapphires, the brow ridged with rivets of silver. It was an imposing visage, to be sure.
Well, barked Bengtsson.
His voice was harsh and deep, with a faint, lilting quality to the accent.
Time's wasting, sir. I believe you had a proposition to bring before me.
Toll removed his hat and stepped before the Admiral's desk. There was no seat. Bengtsson was clearly not a Duardin who relished company.
Hanover Toll, agent of the Order of Azir, he said. I am in pursuit of an individual who has committed untold crimes against the free city of Excelsis. I arrived here by sail, but I fear my quarry further eludes me with every passing moment. I require swifter passage.
Bengtsson leaned back in his chair, making a steeple of his gloved fingers.
The Indefatigable is no passenger ship, he said. Tell me why I should interrupt a profitable trading mission for your convenience.
As I said, I represent the Order.
If the next words out of your mouth are an attempt to threaten me into compliance, I should warn you that the last human to offer me an ultimatum fell for hours before he struck solid earth, said Bengtsson.
Toll raised his hand in acknowledgement and shook his head.
Not at all, Admiral, he said. My position affords me no jurisdiction over the sky fleets of Barak Zilfin. I am well aware of this. But I am in a position to greatly reward those who assist me in my attempts to bring this fugitive to justice. The Order does not forget its allies, Admiral.
Indeed, said Bengtsson. Tell me, who is this fugitive you seek? Who is so important that an agent of Sigmar is sent so far out of his domain to see justice served?
His name is Ortam Vermeier. Recently he has gone by the title of the Golden Lord.
Subtle fellow.
He can be, when the occasion calls for it. For decades, Vermeier was the High Arbiter of Excelsis. There was no more important mortal soul in the City of Secrets.
Until he opened its gates to a demonic invasion, said Bengtsson. I've heard tell of the sacking of Excelsis, Mr. Toll, and of your traitor lord. I am aware of the sizable bounty on that one's head, but tracking criminals is not my business.
Make it your business, and I can offer you more than coin, said Toll.
Bengtsson leaned forward. It was damn strange dealing with someone without being able to look into their eyes. Perhaps that was why the Caradhron were such renowned masters of the mercantile arts. Still, Toll fancied that he could sense the Duardin's curiosity.
You know of Excelsis's greatest export? He said.
Bengtsson waved with a dismissive hand.
Of course, secrets and lies, mined from the Spear of Malice, a relic of the old world, if the legends are true. Slivers of the future from which a man can make his fortune. Tell me, if the city is so rich in prophecy, then how is it that it contains such a multitude of beggars, drunks, and liars? I've traveled to your City of Secrets, Witchfinder, and I've no burning desire to return.
The auguries are real, said Toll. Some are little more than whispers, faint inklings of potential. These we allow the populace to trade and barter as they see fit, for alone they are all but meaningless. But there are greater truths that are mined from the spear, Admiral. Kept under lock and key at the behest of the collegiate. Some are nothing that mortal souls could possibly contemplate, secrets of such shattering power that only the greatest minds of the age could hope to interpret them. Others are simply too valuable to be made public knowledge.
Get to the point, said Bengtsson,
though there was an edge to his voice that betrayed his growing interest.
"I know what the Skyfarers treasure above all else," said Tol. "The breath of Grunyi, the fuel that powers your fleets and your cities, ether gold. If you agree to give me passage, I can grant to you an augury of incomparable value, one that will make you the richest sky captain on the Talon Coast, perhaps in all the realms."
There was silence for a long while. Bengtson's crystal eyes never left the witch hunters. "And the Collegiate, they would agree to this?" he asked at last.
"Of course not," said Tol, "but I have no intention of asking for their permission. I mean to see Autumn Vermeier dead, Admiral, and I will pay any price to see that happen."
Bengtson leaned back in his chair, steepling his fingers and studying the witch hunter. "I'm listening," he said. Chapter 25. In Callis's long and varied experience, the Drowned Rat was perhaps the most depressing establishment he'd ever had the misfortune of visiting. It was a squat, cramped hovel carved out of clay and propped up with mortared bone. The only light sources were a couple of half-heartedly excavated holes in the slanted roof that bled a thin trickle of light across several hide-wrapped stools and tables. The apparent proprietor was a leathery, ancient Duardin with a missing eye and a mouthful of broken teeth, who peered at Callis as if he were a particularly low species of vermin that had crept into his establishment.
"Two ales," attempted Callis.
"Ales?"
spat the Duardin, turning up his considerable nose.
Forgive my ignorance. What's the typical delicacy you serve around these parts?"
"Guama,"
grunted the barkeep, and proceeded to pour a thick, greenish-brown liquid into two clay cups. There was a strong, altogether unpleasant smell, somewhere between damp wood and sewer runoff. Callis offered a thin smile, slotted his last glimmering across the counter, and warily carried the two cups of unspeakable liquid over to where Chev was waiting in one dank corner. He slid the elf her drink across the table. To his surprise, she took up the cup and took a great swig of the stuff. Her face went through several stages of grief and ended somewhere near capitulation.
"Gods, that's rough," she groaned.
Callis took a sip of his own and immediately regretted it. The substance tasted even worse than it smelled, but it did at least leave a satisfying fire in his stomach.
"I hope your man can find us passage," said Chev. "Bilgeport is short of charms, and you can bet our quarry is already nearing his prize."
"Tol can be very persuasive when the need arises," he said, "and he won't allow Vermeier to slip away from him, not again."
Chev frowned, and her lips twitched as if she was about to say something.
"Speak, whatever's on your mind," he said.
It doesn't worry you?" she replied. "The intensity with which he hates this man? I've known men lost to revenge before. It never leads to anything good, Armand."
"Vermeier's betrayal left a scar, that's true," Callis nodded. "But I put my trust in him. He's not led me astray before."
She leaned back in her chair, peering at him through those hazel eyes.
"Why are you out here, Armand?" she asked. "You're no true believer, that's for certain. A man like you who made his name in the battle for Excelsis, even a reclaimed, I'd have thought you set up for life."
He sighed and shrugged. Even that small motion sent a shiver of pain through his chest. If he was honest with himself, he hadn't truly given much thought to why he'd accepted Toll's offer of employment. It was hardly as if the witch hunter had lied about how hard and thankless the work would be.
"For most of my life, I thought the army was my calling," he said, choosing his words carefully. "I was a good soldier. My comrades respected me, I think. It was a tough life, but it gave me structure, purpose. And then, in a moment, I lost it all.
Vermeer's betrayal?
Yes, but that was only a part of it. Everything I had ever known, all the assumptions I had made, the foundations of what I believed in, they were shattered. Suddenly, the world became an infinitely larger and more terrifying place. But somehow...
You found your place in it?
He nodded. I can't really explain it. My life was unmoored and exposed for the lie it had always been. There were demons amongst us all along. But rather than the fear I expected, I only felt a calm assurance, as if my entire life had been leading up to this moment of realization, and now I was truly free.
Maybe I was wrong, she murmured. Maybe you are a true believer after all.
He laughed and raised his cup. She clinked it with her own, spilling a few drops of its foul-smelling contents. He realized he was staring. She was beautiful. The scars were nothing, really. The door of the tavern swung open with a creak. Captain Erika Zenthi, or whomever she was currently pretending to be, strode in, accompanied by Oscus and four other elf corsairs. Zenthi still had her hair covered by a scarlet wrap, and she had ditched her twin swords in favor of a pair of ruby-hilted daggers that were secured crosswise upon her leather armor. The Duardin barkeep shrank back just a bit behind his counter. Obviously, the elves of the Scourge were considered no less enigmatic figures in Bilgeport than they were along the dock districts of Excelsis. "Save the Bilgewater," Zenthi said as she entered, waving a dismissive hand at the nervous Duardin. "I brought something that's less likely to rot my guts from the inside." The captain drew a decanter of amber liquid from within her coat and pried loose the stopper with her teeth. She caught sight of Callis and Chev in their dimly lit corner.
Well, if it isn't Arklis the Tomb Thief and the indomitable Gilder, she said, spitting out the cork and taking a deep draught of the decanter's contents. As she approached their table, her angular nose crinkled in disgust. By the deep, you were actually foolish enough to drink their local fish piss. Gods help you, both of you. Pour that trash out and let's have a proper drink.
Callis sighed and tipped his drink out onto the floor. A small, six-limbed purple-shelled crustacean that had been nestling between the dusty cobbles gave an indignant shriek as it was doused in the sour guama and scuttled away into the shadows. Zenthi poured him a slug of the amber liquid. Her men took tables around the bar. Callis noted that they were far from relaxed. They all carried weapons and had chosen positions which gave them a good view of each entrance. "Expecting trouble," he said, and took a swig. Fiery, but with a pleasant honey-like aftertaste.
"Always," she replied, lowering her voice just a fraction. "Erika Zenthi is not a name that's praised to the topsails in these seas. I've made fools of the high captains far too many times." "Well, as long as they don't know we're here," said Chev.
Zenthi fixed her with an almost pitying stare.
"Of course they do. Or if they don't yet, they soon will. You can't just disguise a ship like the thrice lucky girl. We might have bought some time, but nothing more. We're in the bloody water, and there's sharks circling. Probably the only thing that's holding them back is they expect me to have something up my sleeve."
"And do you?" asked Callis.
"No,"
said Zenthi cheerily. He sighed and drained the last of his liquor. Zenthi refilled his cup.
"Don't worry your precious heads, young ones," she said.
The good captain was grinning honestly for the first time in days. Callis realized that she was genuinely enjoying herself.
"I've been in far worse scrapes than this, and I know the high captains better than they know themselves. Azrek, the runaway slave. Lors, who'd gut his own mother for a glimmering. That fat slug Kaskin, cleverer than you'd give him credit, despite his bluster."
if what you say is true, then might it not be a good idea to lie low somewhere? Whispered Chev. Maybe head back to the ship, or book passage to Excelsis.
Xenthi sighed.
The Thrice Lucky is probably the least safe place in all Bilgeport, she said, then took a long, slow draught of liquor. She's made her last kill. Hull breach like that, you'd need a team of shipwrights working on her day and night for the next span to get her back cutting the waves. She served me well, but like all old wolves, there comes a time when you can't lead the hunt any more. Here's to her memory.
Callis was surprised how sad he was to hear her say those words. He'd hardly enjoyed a moment of his time on the Thrice Lucky, but the wolf ship had cut a path through the worst the Talon Coast could throw at her and brought them out alive. Well, most of them, anyway.
We're here until we can find safe passage back to Excelsis, said Xenthi. With a captain we can trust to keep their mouth shut. Not an easy find.
Or until we find a ship worth stealing, muttered Oscus.
My hopes on that end aren't high, said Xenthi. The state of most of those half-rotted cogs out there in the bay, I'd give it a league at most before they went under. If a shipmaster in my fleet dared let their vessel decay to such a state, I'd have them flayed to the bone.
She drained the last of the amber spirit. Callis and Chev raised their own cups and drank along. Chapter 26. The light was dimming now as Toll made his way back from the skyport. In the distance he could hear the holler of drunken voices and a clatter that was clearly intended to be musical, but fell some way short. Here, though, it was quiet. Disturbingly so. Footsteps. Soft, careful, but unmistakable. He was being followed. Toll took a sudden turn, passing into a narrow alley that ran between two rows of cramped clay huts. Shell fragments mixed with broken glass on the floor, and he had to skip awkwardly between patches of dry earth in order to mask his path. He turned again, and on his right there was an open hole, a makeshift window that led inside one of the crude yurts. With a smooth, practiced grace, he grasped hold of the sill and levered his body into the structure, pressing flat against the far wall. Two shadows drifted past the opening. They stopped briefly, and he heard the hush of whispering voices, though he could not make out the words. The sentiment, however, was easier to grasp. They were confused and angry. After a moment they continued on, following the path ahead. Toll stepped cautiously forward. Something draped in hides and net wrappings lay in the corner of the hovel, and it groaned and muttered something as he passed. There was another opening at the front of the shack, and he passed through, turning to place his feet upon the sill and jumping to catch hold on the rough timber roof. He pulled himself up as quietly as possible and then dropped low as he saw movement across the way on the roof opposite his own. A human form, wrapped in a black cloak, wielding an alley bow. The cross-shaped head of the weapon drifted across the street below as the sniper sought his target.
Me, no doubt, thought Toll.
He had hoped that their presence would go unnoticed for at least another few hours, long enough for him, Callis, and the elf girl to depart upon the Caradron vessel. As always, however, his best-laid plans appeared to have gone awry. The sniper offered a muttered curse and moved closer. He was now no more than 10 feet away, and his back was turned. Toll rose, push dagger clenched between the first two fingers of his right hand. He ran, put his foot on the lip of the roof, and hurled himself across the gap. The crossbowman was just turning when Toll struck him, bearing him to the floor. The man fired, and the bolt shot out from under Toll's arm and disappeared into the night. Barring one hand across the man's throat, throttling his startled grunts, Toll struck out with the dagger, sinking it into the sniper's chest. The man gurgled and spat hot blood onto the side of the witch hunter's face.
Toll did not relent, striking until the man's ragged breathing finally cut off. He heard movement below, and a slow, low whistle coming from the alley running off to the west towards the market square. He grasped the alley bow, its hardwood grip slick with spilled blood, and raised it to his chest. It would be best to keep this quiet. Bracing one foot back, he leaned over the edge of the roof, leading with the muzzle of the weapon. He saw a flicker of motion, little more than a brush of shadow. He fired and heard a gratifying howl of pain in response. He put two more bolts into the inky darkness where the sound had come from, and then rolled backwards as a corresponding scatter of bolts wickered off the roof by his feet, tearing up a cloud of dust and splintered wood.
"Jed! Jed!"
he heard, a panicked hiss. Toll slipped off the roof on the right-hand side, furthest away from the voice and the low moaning of the cutthroat he'd snagged with that last bolt. More footsteps rushing closer, and the flicker of torches at the far end of the alley. This wasn't good. They could easily box him in here, trap him, and run him to ground. Whoever had made their play, they were taking no chances. He rummaged in his coat, fished out the bronze sphere that had so interested Gunnery Sergeant Drock earlier. It vibrated a little, and he gripped each half and rotated his hands. With a satisfying click, the two ends split apart, revealing a thin band of perforated holes along the circumference of the orb. He waited two breaths, then rolled the sphere down the end of the alley, where a huddle of figures was just hoving into view. The sphere spat thick green smoke, which rolled up the red clay walls of the alley, smothering the advancing figures in a choking fog. Toll heard coughing and retching as the acrid gas did its work. Then, raising the collar of his coat to cover his mouth, he ducked low and advanced forward right into the cloud. A figure stumbled out of the haze, holding one gloved hand to its eyes and spluttering. He saw the outline of a broad, well-muscled body clutching a vicious-looking axe. The man looked up from his retching fit as Toll's pistol butt descended towards his face. He managed a startled yelp before the club hit him on the base of the neck, driving him to his knees. Toll swung again and again until he felt the body go limp. Then, just as more figures began to stumble out of the smoke, he rolled the body into a break in the alley to his right and tugged off its black cloak. Sweeping the garment around his shoulders, he grabbed the man's boarding axe, a thick hafted weapon with a double-edged blade, and brought up the cloak's hood.
"Nagash's rotting bones!" spat the nearest figure, leaning against the far side of the alley.
Toll emerged from his hiding space, making a show of rubbing at his own eyes. It wasn't hard, as the choking gas was biting deep into his skin, stinging like demon blood.
"Jed and Hogrim are bleeding out," came another voice. "He's a slippery one."
"The High Captain warned us no less," whispered the first figure.
"I saw him run that way,"
Toll grunted, making his voice a low growl. Whether it was the sting of the smoke or the dim light, the band of cutthroats seemed not to notice that one of their number had been replaced. Muttering curses and threatening bloody vengeance upon their quarry, they began to file past Toll. One of them stretched out a hand to help him along, but he shook his head and pretended to dry heave, waving the man on. As soon as they had filed off into the shadows, Toll's coughing fit miraculously ceased, and he slipped away into the darkness, moving as fast as he dared towards the drowned rat. He only hoped he could reach his companions in time. He was crossing a grimy square littered with broken glass when he saw the silhouettes of figures rise from the low buildings ahead, the gleam of metal in their hands. A hail of bolts slammed into the earth all about him, kicking up a cloud of foul-tasting dust. He froze, knowing that he was marked on all sides.
"You're a talented man,"
came a gruff voice from his left. Sauntering out of the darkness came a Duardin wielding a saw-toothed blade, flanked by two burly henchmen. Toll recognized the burn mark of an escaped slave upon the newcomer's brow, and marked him as High Captain Azrek.
This one had a reputation for sadism and brutality that echoed even on the streets of Excelsis.
"Give it up now," grunted the Duardin. "No way out of this, witchfinder."
Cursing his ill fortune, Tol raised his hands, letting his stolen crossbow clatter to the floor. A figure stepped out from the shadows across the square. As it crossed into the flickering moonlight, Tol saw a featureless golden mask and long, flowing robes of black.
"Autumn," sighed Tol. "I should have known you'd wish to gloat before you finish me. You always did find the sound of your own voice the sweetest symphony."
Vermeia laughed. There was a gurgling wetness to the sound. Following behind the former High Arbiter came a thin, sallow man that Tol recognized as High Captain Lors. Where Azrek and Kaskin flaunted their ambition and indulged in the embellishment of their legend, Lors remained a rarely seen, enigmatic figure. Tol had long marked him as the most dangerous of the three.
"This is foolish,"
muttered Lors, his voice gravelly and strained. The tales said that a former rival had taken a knife to Lors's throat in a drunken brawl.
"You never told us he was a witch hunter. We drain a little blood from Excelsis every now and then and no one notices. We start butchering members of the Order. We'll have the damned Stormbringers at our docks before we know it."
Vermeia rested a hand on the man's shoulder. Lors flinched perceptibly and adopted the expression of a man who had a live blade spider crawling across his face. "No one will ever know what happened here, if you are diligent," he said. "Hanover is a secretive man who operates for months, sometimes years, without contact or support from Arnhem. By the time the Order notes his disappearance, if indeed they ever do, they will have 1,000 other crises to occupy their time. We live in a time of great opportunity, High Captain, if we only have the wit and the boldness to seize it. You think that Arnhem will mark the disappearance of one man while across the far realms their cities are besieged?"
"We exist here only by the barest of threads," said Lors, shrugging Vermeier's hand free. "I'm not fool enough to think we'd last a day if the Scourge fleets sailed upon Bilgeport. Kaskin, Azrek, they see the Sigmar worshippers' indifference to us and mistake it as fear. We overreach ourselves. Only by risking the unthinkable do we forge our destinies," said Vermeia.
"You can stow that mealy-mouthed trash," sneered Lors.
Vermeia was not a tall man, yet he seemed to loom over the High Captain. The air in the vicinity turned thick and oppressive, and Tol imagined that he felt a low, rumbling sound like rushing blood.
"You may leave," said the masked man. "See to your prisoners."
Lors, his face pale and hand twitching towards his gun belt, but never truly threatening to reach it, shook his head and began to stride away, a mob of burly cutthroats forming up around him. Tol heard his boots crunching across the shattered glass of the square as he retreated.
"You need me here for this," said Azrek, running his finger along the flat of his flensing knife. "If there's something you need from this wretch, I'm the man to get it. Always wondered how a witchfinder would fare under the blade."
"That will not be necessary, High Captain. Our business will shortly be concluded."
Vermeia turned his gaze to Tol.
"Here we are, then," he said, "reunited at long last."
Tol thought of 1,000 threats and curses he wished to hurl at the traitor, but gave voice to none of them. He locked his gaze with that impassive mask.
"Nothing to say? You've pursued me across the vast ocean, worked your old bones to dust in order to see me dead,
and when you finally catch up with me, you stand sullen and silent.
Toll's eyes flickered around the square, searching for some form of escape route. Ahead, 100 yards or so to the northwest, he could hear the sound of running water, one of the filth-encrusted canals that sluiced down towards the harbour, carrying the detritus of the city's population. If he could reach it.
"I did truly regard you as a friend, Hanover," said Vermeier.
Toll let out a bark of bitter laughter.
"Don't speak to me of friendship. You betrayed me, Autumn. You made a fool of me for years, decades. You set my city aflame and you allied yourself with demons and witchkin."
"I did as I..."
"And for what?"
hissed Toll.
"For power. For your wretched faith. Look what that has brought you. You wear that mask to hide your face, not because you fear Azir's hunters, but because you fear what you are becoming. Arklis told me what is happening to you, old friend, and why you seek this silver shard."
Vermeier's hand twitched, as if he would reach to unclasp his false face. Then he lowered his hand and gave a soft, sad chuckle.
"You know, there are those who believe I am blessed," he said, "that the reshaping of my flesh is some form of gift from the Changemaker."
"And this is the master to whom you swore your soul?"
asked Toll, shaking his head.
"You're an intelligent man, Autumn, a cultured, educated man. You must know what awaits those who worship the Lord of Lies."
"I am no priest of the gods, Hanover. I never was. I seek only an escape, freedom from the doomed cause to which the God-King has bound us. Strife and endless war against a foe we can never defeat. You of all people should know the futility of this struggle. You have glimpsed the true scale of the powers arrayed against mortal kind. We cannot triumph."
"It doesn't matter," Toll said, shaking his head. "Better death, better oblivion than whatever has happened to you."
"In that we at last find agreement," said Vermeier. "I am done serving the will of gods and monsters, Toll. I will find this silver shard, and I will use its power to remake my flesh. Then I will drive you Sigmarites and your hypocrisy from these lands one city at a time. I will start with Excelsis. Let that wretched place burn first, and let the gods bicker over its ashes."
"That's all you can think of?"
Toll said, shaking his head in disgust.
"All this scheming, and the best you can do is to attempt an atrocity you failed at once before."
"That will serve for now. And it will hurt you, Toll. You reduced me to my current state. It is only fair I destroy your world in turn."
"You'll never stop being a tool of the dark gods, Autumn. Even now, you're dancing to their tune. They own your soul and your fate, and there's no cure that can save you."
Vermeier was silent for a long while.
"I should kill you," he said at last.
"If you leave me alive, I'll come for you. They won't hold me here, not forever. I won't stop hunting you."
Vermeier approached. He clutched his staff tightly, raising it across his chest in two hands. Again, Toll could hear that strange pulsing sound, growing ever louder and more resonant.
"I should," he muttered.
"Why don't you have your slave do it for you?"
said Toll, gesturing to High Captain Azarek.
"This one professes such a love of knife work. I wonder if the High Captain here is such a terrifying scourge of the seas, why is he rotting out here in this wretched hive? surrounded by drunken sots and fools. Could it be that you're just a thug with a blade, Azrek, and there are more terrifying things festering at the bottom of the city's midden pits?
Azrek's eye glazed over with fury.
Oh, I'm going to enjoy skinning the flesh from your bones, boy, said the Duardin,
starting forwards with his blade twirling in his hands.
Azrek, stand back, snapped Vermeier. This is my business.
The High Captain raised a hand, and the crossbows swung away from Tol and leveled at the masked figure. Vermeier hissed in anger.
Don't be a fool, he snapped. You don't ought to talk down to me, masked one, said the Duardin.
He was only a few yards from Tol now, his two bodyguards keeping pace.
This is my city, mine. I will show you what happens to those who insult me in my own hall.
Using the distraction, Tol clenched his wrist and snapped his hand out to the side. The sleeve gun clicked and whirred as the clockwork mechanisms sent it nestling into his palm. He turned and fired at the man on his left. There was a small, sharp crack, and a dark stain spread across the man's shirt. With a small cough, he tumbled backwards into the dirt. The witch hunter was already moving, stepping within the reach of the stunned Azrek and locking his arms around the Duardin's thick neck, driving a knee into the man's leg and knocking him down. Someone loosed their repeater in panic, and the other bodyguard let out a pained shriek as the bolt took him in the leg. Tol saw Vermeier making a shape with his fingers and threw himself aside. A bolt of searing fire flashed past him, engulfing a wooden shack in purple flames. Suddenly, the night was alive with dancing trails of light. Crossbow bolts skittered and slammed into the wall behind Tol as he ran, hands covering his face from the scorching heat of the blaze. He saw Vermeier weave another bolt of fire, but then he was barreling through a decaying gate of mildewed driftwood, which burst apart in a hail of wet shards. He disturbed a colony of yellow-fanged bilge rats as big as hounds, and they scattered, screeching and shrieking in indignation as they flooded around his legs. Something slammed hard into his shoulder blade, tearing through flesh and striking bone, but he did not stop, for he knew that to do so would be to die. Ahead, he could see the curving wall of the canal, and beyond that, the crude, square-shaped line of a sewer outflow, gushing a stream of thick, soup-like brown grey into the river. He slipped on the cobbles, reaching down to steady himself, and a hail of bolts slammed into the wall where his head had been just seconds ago. Then he was running again, and the back street trailed off into a dirty slope piled with filth, broken bottles, and picked clean bones. He skidded down this foul-smelling hill and threw himself into a dive, the oil-sheen surface of the foul canal water reaching up to envelop him with a freezing embrace.
Slippery bastard, cursed Azrek, as he strode along the shoreline searching for Tol's body.
They'd found only his wide-brimmed hat, the torn impact of a crossbow bolt gouged along the left side. But there was no blood, even though the High Captain swore that he'd caught the fleeing man with a thrown blade. Vermeier considered burning the impulsive Duardin alive. His blood was thundering in his veins, and the dark presence that had nestled in his soul demanded a blood sacrifice for this failure. He could, should, have killed the witch hunter outright, but now he was loose, and Vermeier knew Hanover well enough to know that a few wounds would not stay him for long. He cursed. Azrek stared back at him, his expression daring Vermeier to open his mouth. It would be so sweet to peel this arrogant wretch's flesh back from his face, to feast upon his brain matter in full view of his minions, to hear them scream and run in terror. No, not here, not now. Such reckless displays of his power would only draw further attention. Tol was unlikely to be the only agent of Azir operating in these waters. It would be a fine thing indeed to outsmart his nemesis, only to blunder into the gun sights of another bounty hunter or hired killer.
You should find him, he said instead.
You do not want Hanover Toll loose in your city, believe me. He has a way of upsetting things.
He won't. He'll be dead before the opportunity presents itself, snapped Azrek.
I suggest you simply kill your remaining prisoners, rather than allowing them to escape also. Or else you can be assured that your reign as High Captain will be even shorter than most. He scanned the bubbling waters of the canal one last time, but saw nothing. As he turned to leave, Azrek's men leapt aside to clear his way. This had been a setback, but he was still ahead of schedule, and his pursuers had been dealt a heavy blow. It was time to move. The lost city of Zoantica awaited. Chapter 27. The door of the drowned rat exploded inwards, slamming into the far wall with a sound like a gunshot. As the first cloaked figures began to charge through, Xenthi's crew were already on their feet, drawing blades, handbows, and pistols. The first man to enter, a shaven-headed brute wielding a heavy mace, fell, riddled with bolts. There was the crack of a pistol, deafening in the cramped confines of the tavern, and one of the thrice-lucky elves went down with a gargling scream. The Duardin bartender howled, lying flat on the floor with his hands over his head. Callis rose, kicked the table over to free himself, and drew his own weapon.
"The back door!" shouted Chev, huddled in the corner. "More of them!"
Callis swiveled and fired. Splinters flew up as his shot smashed through the shell-covered doorway. He heard a muffled groan on the other side, but it burst open a mere moment later, and more figures poured in. He hurriedly fished a fresh cartridge out of his belt pouch, and as he did so, he saw that Captain Xenthi was sitting idly on her chair amidst the carnage, with an expression of bored indifference upon her face. A bullet ripped past and shattered the glass decanter she held, sending glittering shards of crystal scattering across the floor.
"Oh, enough!"
Xenthi shouted, a look of irritation breaking out across her face at last.
"Enough!"
To Callis's astonishment, the shooting ceased. The newcomers, whoever they were, filtered into the tavern, which was now filled with the bitter tang of gunshots and the smell of freshly spilled blood. Over to Callis's left, someone let out a long, drawn-out moan of agony, soundly ignored by everybody in the room.
"Which of you is it, then?"
Xenthi continued, pacing up and down in the middle of the chaos.
"High Captain Kaskin, do I smell your particular stench wafting in through the door? Or is it the noble Azrek I should be conversing with?"
There was a long silence, broken only by the sound of the barkeep's whimpering. As Captain Xenthi passed his prone form, she aimed a swift kick at his buttocks. He fell silent.
"Erika, my dear," came a high-pitched nasal voice, which was oddly childlike. "It is a pleasure as always. I would ask you and your crew to drop your weapons, if you would be so kind. Otherwise, I'm afraid we may have to resort to knife work, and you know how much I despise needless bloodshed."
Xenthi snorted.
"Oh, you're a saint amongst cutthroats, Kaskin. The gods know it."
The captain gave a curt nod to Oscus, and the brawny elf let his handbow fall to the floor. Xenthi's crewmates did the same, muttering and cursing as they did so, and with no little reluctance, so did Callis. The high captain's men scooped up the fallen arsenal and went through the routine of patting down their captives, searching for hidden weapons. They found a not insignificant arsenal, a vicious collection of punching daggers, knuckle bars, coshes, and razor wire garrots.
"Is it clear?"
came that childlike voice again.
"Aye, sir,"
said the largest of the thugs, a split-nosed brute swinging a heavy two-handed club. A huge man stepped through the door. He was enormously fat and swathed in a crimson silk shirt and bright blue pantaloons, with a ridiculously colossal hat perched jauntily upon his big square head. His arms and hands were bedecked with gleaming jewelry and chunky golden rings, and his broad, youthful face was split in a delighted grin.
"Eureka, Eureka!" he crooned, dipping into an elaborate bow. "It is a wondrous pleasure, as always, my dear. Tell me, how have the seasons been treating you?"
Xenthe took a step closer to Kaskin, and the High Captain's guards immediately closed around him, weapons raised. Kaskin waved them down.
"Rough seas out there, as you know," said Xenthe.
"Oh, as always, I was appalled to hear of the state of the Thrice Lucky, my dear. Such a shame to see a ship that conjures such a ferocious reputation limping into port like a wounded beast. My commiserations, Eureka."
He bent his head and clasped his hands as if in prayer, a gesture that dripped with naked insincerity.
"Gods below, spare me the theatrics, you beached whale," sighed Captain Xenthe. "I assume those other two deviants are nearby. There's no chance you'd have the spine to orchestrate this without them."
"Just so,"
came a voice from the rear entrance. There stood a Duardin, bearing a vicious skull-mark tattoo on the left side of his face, idly spinning a flensing knife in his hand. He was slighter than most Duardin Kallus had known, but there was a whip-like tension to his stance that spoke of swift and lethal grace. He frowned as he noticed the Duardin's face was smeared with blood and flecked with ashes. His jaw was clenched shut, and his eyes were dark slits of malice. He looked like a man ready to kill.
"And Captain Azrek joins our little gathering," laughed Xenthe. "Tell me, Odo, how did the wound I left you at our last meeting heal up? Did I leave a scar?"
The Duardin's face didn't move, but his eyes glinted. Another figure slipped in behind him, entering the tavern cautiously.
"And here's the last of your wretched little triumvirate," said Xenthe.
"High Captain Loss."
"Xenthe,"
nodded the newcomer. He scanned the room, eyes passing briefly over Kallus and resting on Chev. He clicked his fingers, and two of his men moved forward and grabbed the elf by the arms, hauling her towards the door as she kicked and struggled. Kallus took a step forward and immediately drew the aim of several pistols and crossbows.
"What do you want with her?" he said.
Lors raised an eyebrow.
"We don't want a thing. She's just a part of the deal. Sit down."
Kallus's eyes darted about the room, searching for anything he could use to his advantage. Lors had a pistol tucked loosely into his belt and two knives sheathed on a leather strap across his chest. The nearest guard was bleary-eyed, rubbing his temple with the haggard look of someone who had whiled the night away drinking. If Kallus could get hold of the High Captain's blade, kill him quick, and hurl his body into the guard, he would never make it. Too many pistols drawn, and too great a distance. Chev's eyes met his own, and she gave a slight shake of her head. He took a deep breath. She was right. Now was not the time for ill-advised heroics. Then the elf was gone, dragged out into the cloaking darkness.
"I've waited a long time for this," growled Azrek. "And there's no getting away, Xenthe. No one's going to pull you out of the fire this time."
Xenthe simply fixed the Duardin with a cold smile.
"I'm telling you, we should just kill them all now," muttered Lors. "Put an end to it."
"No," said Kaskin. "Bilgeport has to see her die at our hands. They have to know who rules these seas now, from here to Excelsis. That's the only way."
Azrek nodded.
Death's one thing, humiliation's another. They're going in the pit. We're going to host a spectacle, the likes of which the scum of this city have never seen before.
Rough hands grabbed Kallus and the others and dragged them towards the door. Shev tried to keep her footing as they half-carried, half-dragged her down alley after alley. She thought, perhaps, they were heading towards the harbour. She saw the rising silhouette of the High Captain's Tower looming ever closer. It was almost pitch black now, but she could see pale, hostile faces peering out at their party with predatory interest, like carrion birds waiting for their turn at the corpses.
"Keep calm, Miss Arklis," said Ecclesius,
and for perhaps the first time she was grateful for the calming sound of his voice echoing in her head.
"Be ready. I will watch for the right moment, and as soon as I tell you to run, you must make good your escape. We'll get out of this, I assure you. No one can keep Ecclesius the Realmswalker contained for long."
"Here,"
growled the heavy-set man who had her by the arm. She looked up to see an unremarkable two-story building overlooking the harbour bay. She could see the water from here, dark and glinting in the light of a yellow moon. They pushed her inside, where a single brazier lit a featureless room of red clay, casting flickering shadows across the wall.
"Our bargain is concluded," came a familiar voice,
and her blood froze in her veins.
"You may leave."
The High Captain's cutthroats filed out, leaving Shev sprawled in the middle of the room. Darkness loomed in the doorway to her right, seeming to shift and swirl with life. A figure stepped through the portal, a figure she recognized instantly. The expressionless mask of gold shimmered dully in the torchlight, and she thought she could see a faint gleam of silver light deep in its sunken eye-holes.
"Hello, Madam Arklis," said Ortam Vamaya.
"Oh, no,"
said Ecclesius. He crossed over the room towards her, and she thought she caught the spectre of a limp in his stride, a slight spasmodic twitch. There was movement behind the masked man, and in the shadow of the doorway, she briefly saw a flash of bright colour and the shimmering orb of an avian eye, lurid yellow and burning like wildfire. She snapped her hand away, suddenly filled with an intense revulsion. If Vamaya noticed her unease, he did not let it show.
"My dear Shivanya," he said,
and though he spoke softly, those words sent a shiver of caution through her.
"I always knew we would meet again. Please do not be alarmed. I hold no grudge regarding the ill-favored nature of our last meeting. I hold myself responsible for the misunderstanding. Of course you ran from me. I accept full responsibility."
The masked lord leaned close. The stench of ash and quicksilver burned her nostrils. She backed away, desperate to put as much distance between her and this creature as possible.
"I told you once that you and I were destined for great things, Shivanya. I still believe that is true. For now, however, I require two things. The first is your cooperation for the next few days. The second..."
Vamaya stretched out a hand, fingers curling upwards like claws.
"You must," said Ecclesius. "He will take me from you regardless."
Slowly, regretfully, she unhooked her necklace and passed him the crystal. As soon as she removed it from her neck, it was as if she knew true silence for the first time in weeks, like a layer of her subconscious mind had been stripped away. The sensation was unsettling and not entirely pleasant. She had got used to having the Realmswalker's voice around. Vamaya held the orb a moment, staring into its roiling depths. Then he swept it into the pocket of his robes, and gestured for her to follow him. She did not want to. Whatever lurked in that shadowy doorway, she was sure it desired nothing less than to feast on her soul. Vermeer chuckled beneath his mask, a horrid, wet sound.
You have nothing to fear from them, he said. Now, follow me, Madame Arklis. We have business to attend to.
She got to her feet and followed Vermeer out into the night. He led her along the right-hand side of the harbour, lined with shanty houses and crumbling stone walls. Perched upon these crumbling structures were thin, horned figures with jagged beaks and curving horns. Their eyes burned like coals in the darkness, and she shivered as they peered down at her malevolently.
Pay them no attention, said Vermeer. They will not lay a claw on anyone, unless I desire it.
You've certainly improved the quality of your associates, she replied.
He laughed.
You may not believe this, Chevania, but I've genuinely missed your company.
Where are you taking me?
He stopped and turned, raising his staff in one hand. The dark, glittering waters of the harbour began to churn and boil.
We're going for a ride upon this, a gift from my new allies.
A shape emerged from the water, shining in the moonlight. It was a length of red-tinged crystal, perhaps half as long as the thrice lucky, fashioned in the rough shape of an arrowhead. At the edges, the crystal folded back to form jagged walls, and a fan of spear-length spines jutted out from the sides of the bizarre vessel, like the fins of a deep-sea creature. Chev noticed that the underside of the craft was lined with strangely organic-looking hook shapes, like curved teeth. At the center of the vessel rested a pulsing core of purplish light, and when Chev made the mistake of gazing at the emanation, she felt her head spinning and her stomach turn. There was a sense of utter wrongness about this ship, about these creatures. Vermeer stepped aboard the crystal ship as it emerged onto the dockside and held out his hand for her to follow. She did not deign to take it, instead grudgingly making her own way aboard. Though the surface was slick with water and smooth as ice, she found that she could easily keep her balance. The vessel radiated a strange heat. The avian creatures moved to join them, not taking their eyes from her. They muttered and clicked in their own strange tongue as they boarded. Others, she saw, had mounts of their own, ugly, disc-shaped creations, similarly organic in appearance and lined with razor-sharp blades and serrated teeth. As they stepped aboard these bizarre devices, they began to lift into the air with a droning hum. Vermeer intoned an arcane phrase, and the crystal ship followed suit, rising swiftly and gracefully into the night sky. It made not a sound as it rose into the air, but soon the shimmering bay of Bilgeport spread out before them, and they could see the light of the Corsair port twinkling and fluttering beneath. Somewhere down there were Tol, Kallus, and the others, at the mercy of the high captains. Chev was not much for praying, but she beseeched any gods that were listening to help her friends survive what was coming. Chapter 28 Kallus and the others spent the rest of the night in a lightless, stinking dungeon, somewhere near to the dock district, listening to the shouts and drunken chanting of Bilgeport's noble populace. Huge, evil-eyed rats scurried across the rough stone of Kallus's cell, and he whiled away the few hours until dawn by pinging rocks at them. Xenthi's snores reached him from the opposite cell, and he shook his head in baffled astonishment. How could she sleep so easily at a time like this? They needed to get out of here. They needed to pick the lock or bribe the guard or something, anything. In a mad rush of fury, he stood up and crossed the chamber to rattle the rusted iron bars. Hey! He shouted, hoping to draw someone near.
Hey, you out there!
There was no response. Gods, but his head was throbbing. Whatever Xenthi had given him to drink had skipped straight to the hangover.
Rest your bones, Gilda,
came Oscus's soft, calm voice. He was leaning against the bars of the cell next to Xenthi's, studying his fellow captive with calm amusement. Callis felt a powerful desire to punch him in the jaw.
What's your plan, then, exactly? He snapped. Wait until dawn to get ourselves drawn and quartered?
Oscus yawned.
There's naught to be done,
he said, with an unspeakably irritating lack of concern.
Not yet. You see those bars? There's no give there. There's no locks to pick or secret tunnels to escape by, so, yes, we wait. They've already made their mistake by not killing us outright when they had the chance. We'll find our moment, and we'll make them pay. Or we'll all die, painfully.
Oh, that's brilliant, sighed Callis, slumping down to the floor and aiming a kick at a particularly ugly grey-white rat that had ventured too close. Not for the first time I count myself fortunate to serve as acting crewman on the good ship Thrice Lucky. Long may she sail.
Careful, boy, said the first mate, softly.
Callis ignored him. His thoughts drifted to Toll. Where was the witch hunter? Had he been captured too? Maybe he was lying dead in a gutter somewhere, killed by the very man he had sought to bring to justice. And Chev, she was at the mercy of the maniac Vermeier, and there was nothing he could do about it. Purplish light began to seep through the cracks in the ceiling, drawing vertical streaks across Callis's cell. Dawn was fast approaching. He curled up in the corner of his cell, as far away from the skittering rats as possible, and tried to sleep. He had only snatched a few precious minutes of sleep, when the clatter of boots and a chorus of shouts forced him awake. He dragged himself to his feet. His head throbbed painfully, and his mouth was bone dry. Down the corridor came a score of armed men and women, rattling clubs and blades against the cells as they approached, making a din that did Callis's tender head no favours.
Up you get, scum!
Barked the leading figure, a huge brute of a woman, with one side of her head shaved, wielding a vicious barbed whip. She stepped up to Callis's cell and unlocked the door, and two of her burly associates rushed in to drag him out with little regard for care or restraint.
It's time for you to put on a show, said the woman, with a black-toothed grin. Don't disappoint me now. You're to give the audience good sport before you croak it.
That will certainly be the first thing on my mind, said Callis, earning himself a painful clout from one of his captors.
Xenthi and her crew were bundled out of their cells alongside Callis, though he noted that the guards were rather reluctant to lay hands upon the elf corsair or her accomplices. For her part, Arika Xenthi was the picture of indifference. She stifled a yawn as they strode up the steps of the dungeon, and out into bright sunlight, and the hoots and jeers of a gathering crowd. They were in a plaza of sorts, dominated by a gaudy bronze statue of a buxom mermaid carrying an amphora, from which she poured a torrent of water into a hexagonal marble-tiled